Parshas Emor, Chelek Chav Beis, Volume 22, Sicha Gimel, Third Sicha. In this week's Torah portion of Emor, the four species that are gathered together for the first day of the holiday of Sukkot are listed. In Chapter 23, Perek Chav Gimel, Verse 40, Pasuk Mem, we read, Ulekachtem Lachem Bayem Harishin, Pri Eitz Hadar, Kapes Tmorim, Vanaf Eitz Ovis, Vaarve Nachal. And you shall take for yourself on the first day the fruit of the Hadar tree, date palm fronds, a branch of a dense leaved tree, and willows of the brook. Reading this verse, we notice something surprising. In regards to the first three species, the fruit of the Hadar tree, the date palm fronds, and the branch of the dense braided tree, the Torah indicates the specifics as to what is to be selected in each of these species, conditions without which these species cannot be used for the mitzvah. The Pri Eitz Hadar tells us that the esrog, which is the fruit of the Hadar tree, must be attractive, and a dried fruit would be unfit for the mitzvah. The kapos tamarim, the fronds of a date palm for the lulav, must be pliable so that they can be connected, bound to the spine, and not spread. And if this cannot be, then it is not fit for use in the mitzvah. And the Ragat Shavar says the same is true in regards to the species. It's not sufficient that the tree that the lulav comes from is only a date palm. In regards to this species, it must also produce dates. Only from that type of tree is a lulav fit for the mitzvah. This is how the Ragat Shavar explains what our sages say in the Tractate of Menachos, that of the four kinds needed for the mitzvah, two of them produce fruits, when in fact a myrtle too produces a fruit, it produces berries. But he explains this to mean that the lulav must be from a branch that brings forth dates, and it is otherwise not fit for use as a lulav, which is not the case regarding a myrtle branch that does not have the same requirement that it be from a berry-producing branch. In regards to the hadas, the myrtle, it must be dense, with three leaves emerging from each base, otherwise it is unfit for use. But in regards to the willow, the fourth species, which is described as a willow of the brook, even a branch from a willow that does not grow by the river, but instead is from a non-irrigated field, it is fit for the mitzvah. As long as it is of the willow species that grows usually along a brook or body of water, it is fit for use for the mitzvah of the four species to begin with, even if what one ultimately uses did not grow beside a brook. Why? We need to understand why are the willows different to the other three of the species? Why is the willow generalized in Torah by its genus with no specifics in terms of the actual willow to be used for the mitzvah? In the Talmud, in the Tractate of Sukkah, there's an opinion that this law that teaches that even a willow that grew in a desert or in the mountains is kosher. And this is explained as learned from the plural terminology used in the Torah, Arvei Nachal, willows of the brook, with the intention that we understand that this includes even a willow that doesn't grow beside a brook. And this law in and of itself too requires explanation. Why is the Torah so specific in regards to the details of the source of these three species of esrog, lulav, and hadas that may be used for the mitzvah, but just generalizes about the willow, stating that it is a willow of the brook And along with that, according to Maimonides, most of the commentaries teach, and according to the Shulchan Aruch, it seems that it's understood from the verse itself that while most of this species grows beside a brook, one may take an arava from the rare and seldom seen willows that grow in a desert or on the mountains, as this too is suitable for use in the mitzvah. Commentaries add to this and say that the understanding that one may make use of an arava from the desert or from the mountains is not in fact determined by the plural usage of the word willows, because that plural usage is to teach us that we require that there be at least two aravas taken. So it turns out that according to the opinion of Maimonides, the description that the Torah uses, arve nachal, in plural, is informing us only generally of this genus, not specific to the kind of willows that are to be or may not be used for the mitzvah. So it remains unclear, where does this come from? Why is it like this? Why the difference between the three species and the specifics for where they're coming from and the fourth species, the willow? The Rebbe continues and says, we've often discussed that there are concepts in Torah that are, at the simplest level, not clearly understood. The pshat on its own cannot be understood, and it's only through midrash, through allegory and the mystical, that we can understand them in their full depth. As Rashi teaches on the very first verse in Torah, in his explanation, he says, the verse demands a midrashic interpretation in order to be understood. This is the case here as well. The differences that we see between the four species can be understood according to the following midrashic interpretation. In the explanation of Vayikra Rabbah, we're taught that the four species allude to four types of Jews. The Esrog, which has both taste and scent, alludes to the Jew who studies Torah and does good deeds. The palm fronds of a date tree, the lulav of the date tree, which has taste but no smell, alludes to the Jew who has Torah but lacks good deeds. The hadas, the myrtle, has a lovely smell but no taste, and this alludes to the Jew who does many good deeds but does not have Torah. And the willow, which has no taste and no smell, alludes to the person who has no Torah and has no good deeds. And the intention of bringing the four kinds together is to bind all four into one gathering, all four types of Jews united in a single bond. There is thus obviously a very essential difference between the first three species and the willow. The first three allude to three types of Jews who have an obvious connection between them with obvious positive qualities, and their ability to unite comes from that. As the saying goes, a thief isn't one who's capable of stealing, he steals in actuality. A scholar isn't one who can study, he's a person who actually studies. Certainly the value of good deeds is specifically expressed when those deeds are done. On the other side of the spectrum is the willow, which alludes to the Jew who has no Torah and no good deeds. And the bond between them all is that they are all Jews, an internal quality that exists for every Jew, descendants of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, even when one has no Torah and no good deeds, and even when one is so lost and lives among non-Jews and doesn't even know that he or she is Jewish. This idea manifests in the actual laws of this mitzvah. The first three species have to have obvious specifications in their genus to be used for this mitzvah. But the willow can be used even if it doesn't grow beside a brook, like the Jew who is living among the Gentiles and doesn't know that he's Jewish. It's sufficient that it is of the willow genus, that he or she descends from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that is already a willow fit for use in the mitzvah, and it can become bound together with the other three species and part of the mitzvah of the four kinds. And it's worth pointing out that the moniker of this species, Arava, which is the original word in Lashon HaKodesh, in the Holy Tongue, is the same as the word pleasant, Arev, like the verse in Malachi that says, "And then the offerings of Judah and Jerusalem shall be Arevim, pleasant to the Lord." So this Jew is pleasant to God. We learn a very clear lesson from this. First and foremost, we must know that we must connect to every Jew, even with the simplest, because to properly observe the mitzvah of the four kinds, one must have all four, just like one cannot fulfill this mitzvah without an esrog or a lulav or a hadas. So too, one cannot fulfill this mitzvah without willows, without the simplest Jew. In fact, because the simple Jew's connection to God is just to the very essence of God, it's only through connecting to this Jew that one can really connect to the absolute simplicity of essential godliness. There's an additional lesson here, and that is that there's a difference in the way one connects to the other three categories of Jews and the way that one connects to the simple Jew. A Jew who can achieve the level of one who studies Torah and does good deeds is required to actualize that, to study Torah and to do good deeds. This Jew cannot just hang on to his or her background, coming from a family of scholars, or being enrolled in a yeshiva, or relying on having once learned in a yeshiva. The taste of this experience of Torah study must be ongoing, and the same is true for his good deeds. But in bringing close a simple Jew, there should be no conditions, neither the obligation to study, nor the demand that he or her consciously express their Jewishness. First, connect to the Jew because he or she is a Jew, because a pure Avos Yisrael. And if he doesn't feel the connection, then be deeply compassionate, because compassion brings one to great love. This path of love, just because one is a fellow Jew, leads to the ultimate opportunity to bring a person close to Torah itself, and to lift a person up to the level of both taste and smell. This explanation, that there is a difference in how we connect, is aligned with the opinion that a condition of the frond of the date palm for the lulav is that it comes from a fruit-bearing branch. But there are other opinions that say that the words kapos tamarim, a fruit-bearing tree or branch, is a generic name for a genus, like willows of the brook. And in fact, fronds from a non-fruit-bearing palm tree are also suitable for use in the mitzvah. So let's explain the difference between the indicators that the Torah gives for an esrog and a myrtle, and the indicators for a lulav and a willow, according to these two opinions. The bonding and raising of the four species, the four kinds, is among the loftiest of mitzvahs, of action-oriented mitzvahs, as opposed to prayer or study, because it needs to bring a true and complete union between all types of Jews, unifying in this way the four letters of the tetragrammaton of God's name. And the opinion we mentioned, which is the opinion of the Rogatchover, that he suggests that no, there is a detail that will hold up this mitzvah from being observed and this complete union from happening, and that is the lack of good deeds. Not only will it hold up the unity, but the fulfillment of this mitzvah also achieves, as the Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah teaches, atonement, that these are able to atone for those who lack. And more than that, the whole spiritual formula of the mitzvah will be disturbed if there's a lack of good deeds, similar to the explanation given in the portion of Chukas regarding why it was not Aaron who brought the sacrifice of the red heifer, but his son Elazar, as the prosecutor, Aaron, who was involved in the making of the golden calf, cannot become defender. In that case, we must say that the lulav and the willow achieve in the performance of this mitzvah what must be achieved by virtue of their very essence. The Jew who has no good deeds is part of this complete bond, because like the Jew who has no Torah and no good deeds, who does not even know that he is Jewish, it is his essence that he or she is a descendant of our forefathers. And this is stronger when revealed in its totality, bonded together with the Esrog and Hadassim, than actions. According to this explanation, we understand another idea, which is that there is an even greater formula in the bonding with the lulav over the bonding with the willow. One who has Torah but has no good deeds is in fact worse off than one who is completely ignorant of Torah. One who has no Torah knowledge at all knows no better. But one who is a scholar in Torah and yet his study does not bring him to action is much worse off. Like our sages teach regarding one who is a scholar in Torah, his unintentional sins become considered as intentional. And this teaches us another lesson, that the obligation to connect to every single Jew, so that every Jew is bonded in a single gathering, is not only in regards to saving someone's spiritual life, like the Jew who knows nothing because he is, so to speak, like a child taken captive. He or she never had the opportunity to learn about his Jewishness and has never tasted his heritage. But even one who does know that he is Jewish and nevertheless does not observe, he too needs our time, and we must attach ourselves to him in a close bond. And we need him with us to fulfill this mitzvah of connecting all Jews into one bond fully. It's only through the connection and union of all types of Jews that we can serve to atone for one another, both for unwilling sin and also to bring an atonement before God, which brings great pleasure to our Creator. And this connection will ultimately shift things above. There will be an elevation which will take place on high and will bring down the complete redemption, for we cannot be redeemed until we are all one united entity.